Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Man, that sunset is gorgeous.
Grill, patio, sunset. Hard to get better than that. Unless you're browsing Carvana's inventory while you soak it all in.
Oh, burger time.
So sit back, get comfortable. Carvana's got thousands of cars under $20,000 just waiting for you.
I could stay here forever.
Carvana, where car buying meets comfort meets convenience. Download the app or visit Carvana.com today.
Don't touch that dial. You're tuned in to the Dread Podcast Network.
Welcome to Development Hell. For every horror movie that hits VOD, countless others end up DOA. Development Hell is the podcast dedicated to unearthing these cursed horror productions. We're going to find out what went wrong, and then decide if these titles still stand a shot at the green light. I am your host, Josh Korngut. I am the managing editor of Dread Central. I am also a filmmaker in Toronto, Canada. This podcast is a proud member of the Dread Podcast Network. Hi, everybody, and welcome back to a brand new episode of Development Hell. Today we are discussing the upcoming big-budget theatrical adaptation of Salem's Lot. This episode, we're going to talk about Salem's Lot, the novel, the 1979 miniseries, and what the hell is going on with this upcoming reboot, I Want to Know. We are joined by a very special guest, Jen Adams. You might know Jen from writing for Dread Central, Bloody Disgusting, and hosting the essential horror podcasts, Psychoanalysis and The Losers Club. Jen, how's it going?
It's going great. How are you?
I'm doing good. Thank you so much for joining me. Could you introduce yourself to the Development Hell audience?
Yes. Hello. My name is Jen Adams. And yes, I'm a writer and podcaster. And I often say Stephen King is my favorite person I've never met. So I will talk about him till the end of time. And I love this book, and I'm very, very excited to talk about the upcoming adaptation-ish, question
ish,
mark?
Question mark, 2020 question mark.
Right.
I'm very lucky to have you here today because you are very well-versed in the landscape of Stephen King. We're getting some of our information today from The Hollywood Reporter and from Deadline. Jen, would it be okay if I started off by giving just like a brief seminar on Salem's Lot, the novel?
Absolutely.
So Salem's Lot, an early Stephen King book, published, I believe, 1975. I think it's actually his second book.
It's his second published book.
Published book. So I guess that's second just to Carrie.
Yeah, I think he wrote about three before that that would end up being Bachman books later.
Oh, what were the three previous?
I believe, I might get one of these wrong, but I believe, I know Rage, and I know, I think Roadwork and The Long Walk, but it might be The Running Man substituted for Roadwork.
Like Incel Trilogy.
Exactly.
Gotta get into that.
His Angry Young Men
book. Yeah. Well, this book revolves around a writer by the name of Ben Mears. This is a guy that returns to a town named Jerusalem's Lot, shortened for Salem's Lot in Maine. And he lived there, I believe, when he was just a child for a couple of years. And at that time, I think he discovered something like very disturbing, or that's his memory anyways, in one of the houses in town that he becomes obsessed with and then revisits this town later in life to write about it. But the town is infested with vampires.
Uh-oh.
Yeah. This story was revisited a couple of times on Page. There's also the short story Jerusalem's Lot, which I think was in Night Shift. And this is something I learned today, One for the Road, I think also in Night Shift. I'm very familiar with Jerusalem's Lot. I've read it, but I've not read One for the Road. I'm assuming you're familiar.
Oh, yes. One for the Road is great. I actually prefer One for the Road to Jerusalem's Lot. Although I will say, if you've seen Chapel Wait, that was an adaptation of Jerusalem's Lot, the short story with Adrian Brody. I was very pleasantly surprised by that. I thought it was great. But yeah, One for the Road is like one of those classic King stories of like two old codgers who are like in a main general store and a snowstorm hits and a family is driving through town. And they have taken a wrong turn through Salem's Lot, which is now essentially just home to vampires. It's like the ghost town.
Cool.
And terror ensues. So it is, it's a great short story. And I'm surprised that it hasn't been, it hasn't gotten like a big adaptation, but it has gotten a lot of Dollar Baby adaptations, I think. It has been on that list for a while.
Cool. Okay, so it's Snow King. I love Snow King.
Oh, it is Snow King. Snow horror is one of my favorite things in the world. Yes, it is very snowy. The vampire, the snow, the vampire in the snow. It's great. It's not quite 30 Days of Night, but it is also delightful. So,
what is some? There's so much good Stephen King in the snow. You've got Misery. You've got
The Shining.
The Shining. The Dead Zone.
Yep. Dreamcatcher.
Dreamcatcher. Oh, yeah. Storm of the Century. Oh, my God. It keeps going. Yep. It keeps going. Mm-hmm. Okay, but back to Salem's Lot, which isn't necessarily very snowy. Question for you. What was your first encounter with this book? Where did you first meet it?
Well, I grew up looking at it on my dad's shelf, and we had the paperback. And it was like one of those old vintage paperbacks where the cover is all black, and it's got like the imprint of a vampire. And then the only color on it was the blood coming, dripping from the kid's fangs. And so I was really interested in it. And then I read, and once I had already kind of decided Stephen King was like the thing, I picked it up and I started reading it. And I got to the part, which is one of the very first things that happens, where Susan and Ben are meeting in the park and they're talking about air dance. And I was like, this is so 70s. I cannot do this. And so I just put it away. And then years later, I went back once I read a lot more King and just fell in love with it. It is one of, I put it in my top 10. I think it's one of my favorites of his books.
Wow. I think it's in my top. Sometimes it's my number one novel. And yeah. I think it's like a crazy thing to say because there's so many.
It's my husband's favorite too.
Oh yeah. Okay.
Yeah. And I was like, when we started dating, that was how I knew he liked me, is because he started listening to it, the audiobook on the way to and from our date. So
I love that's so romantic and spooky. Was the date crazy. By the lake? And
it was not. Unfortunately, it was not by the lake.
Oh my god!
A little bit more landlocked here, but
when they were talking about, I was rewatching the miniseries today, and there's a point where they're like, "Where should we go on our date? Like a movie somewhere? The lake?" And I was like, lake, "Oh, that's so horny."
I know.
Yeah, I love this book, too. I encountered it a little bit later in life. It was one of the later of the Stephen King books that I've actually read. It was not in order. And I fell in love with it. I find it to be so moody and ultimately just so scary. And I think that's what I'm looking for in movies and in TV and in books. I'm just, like, always chasing the scare. And it's surprisingly difficult to find.
Yeah.
And this really did it, reading it and listening to the audiobook. Like, I remember being like, this is a fucking scary story and I love it so much. Why do you, first of all, do you agree? Do you find it to be scary?
Oh, absolutely. I do. And I find it overtly scary too, which is something that I really like about vintage King, you know, like as much as I love everything he's, not everything, but I love all stages of his career. Like there are gems in every period of his writing. But I find certain phases to be a lot less scary and more introspective or more like dramatic or more emotional. And the vintage King stuff, that really early stuff, I find really scary. Like we've got The Shining and Salem's Lot and Carrie and Firestarter, which is maybe not so scary, but it's like, it's a really easy scariness to kind of, I don't know, access, you know, like they're vampires, and they're very scary vampires, and they will get you. And there's a lot of like creeping in the night. There's a lot of darkness. Mm-hmm. And in addition to that, there's like the darkness of the town itself, and how some of these people are very good people and some of them are really awful. And some of them don't mean to be awful, but they just kind of do awful things. And so there's that darkness there too. So it really hits on a lot of different levels. And then there's the terror of losing a child. And it really hits on all levels. And it's so succinct too. You know, it's not like, I want to say it's around 400 pages. Like, it's not one of his longest books. And it really kind of, not to be obnoxiously punny, but it really goes for the jugular, you know, and it just kind of languishes around in all the blood that's spurting out. And I just eat it up every time.
Okay, well, that's beautiful. Thank you for that. And yeah, it does do the terror of the small town and like the terror, mm-hmm. like the terror of the human beings in these small towns that,
yeah, the human, you know, monsters.
Yeah. It went full hog on that, like mm-hmm. balls to the walls on that. And you can feel him starting to really play with that here. Mm-hmm. But it feels a little bit more subtle. Yeah. And a little bit more serious. It felt, mm-hmm. I was thinking about the book today compared to some of his later books, and I feel like he was trying to be more literary early on before he was really comfortable in his own voice. Mm-hmm. And I find this to be very literary. I find it to be really scary too. There's something about that, the whole story of the Martson house and what Ben Mears saw, or what he thinks he saw there as a child, and who Hubie Marston was. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering, because I'm dumb and confused, can you tell us a little bit about like the Marston house history, what Ben saw there, and like who Hubie was?
Yes. So Hubie Marston is kind of he's like a prohibition era bad guy, gangster kind of. He's the kind of guy who would have like a suite in The Shining, the Overlook Hotel. A lot of money. He's made it through nefarious means, some just illegal, but there's also hints of like some black magic, I'm saying in quotation marks, or some kind of like demonic deals with darker entities or something. He's gotten his money and his power through bad means. And so he is just kind of this malevolent force that lives in this house, and kind of the house becomes kind of infused with his evil essence. And in that way, it kind of becomes a magnet for other kind of evil or nefarious people. You know, it's kind of like a pole that attracts. And so when Ben Mears is a kid, like this is the, I'm blanking a little bit on where the timelines of this line up. I believe that Hubie Marston was already dead by the time Ben Mears has gotten to the house. But Hubie Marston, he and his wife, they end up dying in what looks like a murder-suicide. They find a whole bunch of shit. And I think money and like, I don't know, just junk in the house. It's this super old, really creepy, awesome house, like picturing the Psycho house. And so that becomes like the local boogeyman house, like the Myers house in the town. And so mm-hmm. kids are always daring each other to go up and steal something from inside, or just prove that you've been inside in some way. And so Ben Mears is trying to be cool with the cool kids in town and walks in and sees Hubie Marston hanging from the banister, I believe, mm-hmm. in the living room, and which is where he died. And so he essentially sees the ghost of Hubie Marston. And the 2004 miniseries plays with this in some interesting ways. But so this becomes like this really nightmarish moment that kind of haunts Ben Mears for into adulthood. And that is what's kind of drawn him back to the town.
Mm-hmm. I love how this is an early version of Stephen King playing with an evil property. And it's scary. Mm-hmm. And I think we're hard on him as a culture for like making inanimate objects spooky. But it's so scary the way that he does it. It's so unique and haunting. And I just love the whole Marston House sort of origins. I don't remember if it was in the book or if it was in the miniseries or if I literally just invented it, but was he like, was there like stuff about child abuse associated with Hubie?
With I think so. The 2004 miniseries hints on that a lot. I don't remember anything overt other than there may have been some kind of child sacrifice with the...
Oh my God.
Yes.
Whoa.
But I don't think he was necessarily a child predator. I think that was just part of his overall evil. And, you know, kids may have been what was called for him, whatever recipe he was cooking up for his... But what I remember, what I recall is, and it's been a couple of years since I've reread it, but that he's just kind of an evil man. Now, the 2004 adaptation specifically kind of says he's a child murderer and kind of hints that maybe there was something more darker than, if there is something darker than child murder, but there was another element to that that may be too dark for us to talk about.
That'd be a cool, like, spinoff, like some, like a Marston, I don't know, origin film.
I mean, yeah, I would watch that.
Right?
See, I mean, not to jump ahead, but I mean, I might want that more than a remake, you know?
Mm-hmm. Something a little bit different, but playing with it. Yeah, yeah. Kind of giving Pet Sematary Bloodlines ? Energy. So
Yeah. Well, and what I think is interesting too, because, you know, that did become the joke, is like, oh, a haunted lamp, you know?
Yeah.
And I think that that a lot of times is a commentary given by people who don't spend a whole lot of time reading King, you know, and mm-hmm. I don't mean to say that as a jerk, but like,
no,
because
it's
the lamp is the focal point for so many other things. Like, there's always more to that story. Like, it's not a haunted car. It's a friendship that's falling apart. And the haunted car is the vehicle to explore that, you know,
mm-hmm. Except for Uncle Otto's truck. Pretty sure that was just a haunted car.
That story, I forgot that about that. That story is awesome.
I love it. It's so fucking good and simple. And that's why I like Stephen King so much.
Exactly. Me too. He can go deep and he can just keep it simple and still scare the shit out of you.
I'm also like a fan of how anti-Hollywood it is to murder children. And he's just not afraid to do that. And I love that for him.
I know.
The Glick deaths are so scary in the book, not in the miniseries.
Yeah.
But that's another thing that I think makes this specifically scary. And the last thing I want to bring on board to this, like, why is this novel scary section is there's two minor characters. You're going to have to help me out with their names. The two that are having the affair, Fred Willard and Lady.
Bonnie is, hold on. Oh, let me look it up. I know Bonnie is the woman. Uh-huh. And Cody, I can't remember exactly what their names are, but yes,
I remember that being really frightening when I read the book for the first time, like in the most quintessential Stephen King cruelty sort of way. Will you sort of fill us in for people that maybe don't know about the subplot?
Yes, I will. Yes, so Bonnie is a bored housewife, and she has been sleeping with the younger, I believe he's the cable man or the telephone repairman, something. He makes frequent visits and they're hooking up while her husband, who is this big burly man about town, lots of shotguns kind of guy, is out. He finds out that she is sleeping around and they have a big confrontation. And it is horrific. Like it's horrific at a time when we were not talking about intimate partner violence the way we are now. And I don't say that to say it doesn't age well, because it does. It is very, it shows how cruel and how horrific that kind of stuff is. But so he, I don't want to spoil exactly what happens, but he threatens to kill Cody, who is the other man. And puts a shotgun in his mouth too. Like he honestly believes he's about to die, and then gives him the chance to get out of town. And that's when he meets the vampires. And you would think that that is the most terrific part of the scene. But what is later is that he quote unquote punishes Bonnie.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't get a lot of the specifics of that, but we get enough to understand how awful it is. And yes, it is a terrifying scene.
Yeah, it's after all these years, it's one of the scenes that really stick with me most. Mm-hmm. in this book. And I think it just shows how strong King is at characters.
Yep.
Which I think is a smooth transition to talking a little bit about the characters in this book. I think it was offline. We were sort of talking shit about Ben Mears. So I want to start there. Ben Mears, you know, he's our antagonist. He kind of feels like a King sort of, what's a good word? Like transplant in a way. He's
like this
young, hunky like writer.
He's our first writer protagonist in King's Dominion.
I mean, it's the second book.
Exactly. Yeah, he didn't waste too much time.
Yeah, but no, you're right.
Tommy Ross writes a poem, so.
Oh, right.
But it's not his job. Sorry, that's me splitting hairs.
It starts fast. So, okay. Who's Ben? What? How do you feel about Ben?
He's fine. He is, I think, one of the least interesting characters in this book. There's nothing wrong with him. I think he's fine. He is a pretty clear King parallel. And I know in interviews he's kind of talked about, or maybe it was a foreword to a novel, he's talked about writing this book, and he's talked about like Ben Mears wanting to become braver and wanting to become more. And I do think that he kind of carries the quartet towards the end of the story. But he just is, he's kind of milquetoast, you know, he's a writer. He has recently lost his wife, Miranda, in a motorcycle accident. So he's also kind of driven back to Salem's Lot by this house. But a lot of it is to kind of have a project, I think, to deal with this grief over Miranda. And he starts dating Susan Norton. And I think that is interesting because of Susan Norton's issues with her mother, not necessarily because of Ben. Ben's fine. Ben does what you want him to do, but he is the least interesting main character. You know, he's like a stuffed blue chambray work shirt, I guess.
Ouch. I totally agree. Considering how much I love this book, the two leads kind of, in my opinion, are snorefests. Susan is... to me, definitely not that interesting. I mean, yes, he suffers when it comes to writing his women characters often, but Susan feels especially, like, I don't know, mousy and kind of hard to get into. How do you feel about Susan, poor Susan?
I like her. She is, you know, there are a lot of King female characters that I really love, and she's in the middle of the ones I love and the ones that I really don't like.
Mm-hmm.
I always love a good King Smackdown scene, you know, and she has a really great argument with her mother. And there's this really interesting, you know, she's wanting to break free and she's wanting to date who she wants and not like get sucked into this like stereotypical Salem's Lot. She's not wanting to become her mother, essentially. Mm-hmm. Her mother is really trying to tighten her grip on her daughter. And I find that really interesting. And that's about it. And I also, you know, there's, she is kind of, she's not a factor in the end of the book too, you know? So I think she comes in, she makes her entrance. She talks about her art and then she kind of skedaddles, you know?
Yeah.
So,
I mean, there's an archetype or sort of dual archetypes in this book that I always find really fascinating. And that's Straker and Barlow.
Yeah.
So Barlow is our main antagonist. He's the sort of ancient vampire Nosferatu Dracula type. And Straker is, I think, mostly human assistant. And it's giving Renfield Dracula energy and also a little, I mean, it's done really well in Fright Night as well.
I was just gonna say,
and I always find it to be so gay and so not just gay but like male homosexual dynamic gay in a way that like we really fear sort of male couples, and they're always sort of in the shadow of night doing things that they shouldn't be doing. And there's also a sense of like tragedy between them. And like love is definitely there in all three of the stories that we're talking about. Mm-hmm. But it's like this toxic, horrible love that like leads to so much death. And I'm wondering do you think I'm reaching when it comes to this queerness of these archetypes? And did you feel it a little bit in this story?
I don't think you're reaching at all. I will say, as a straight person, I don't always pick up. So I did not pick up on any queerness on my first reads. but now I can definitely see it. And there's, especially for a novel written in 1975 or published in 1975, I should say, there is a kind of stereotypical queerness. You know, they own an antique store.
I was going to say.
They are very erudite, you know, and I don't, I don't personally find it like a negative stereotype. You might disagree with me on that. And I would, you know, tend to go with your understanding of it. But yeah, there is like, it's like a dark devotion to these two characters. And I really enjoy that. You know, I've never been a huge fan of Renfield and Dracula together because there's so much dominance from Dracula. And I find like with Barlow and Straker, it seems to be much more of a partnership, like Jerry, and I'm blanking on his dreamy, melty Carpenter, yeah. But yeah, that's the vibe that I get a little bit more than Renfield and Dracula, you know?
It's so funny that you bring up the idea of the dominant and the submissive. Mm-hmm. You're right. When it comes to the Dracula story, it's so hardline that it is kind of like maybe not that interesting. But I do find that sort of top and bottom dynamic does exist in Fright Night and in, you know, Salem's Lot and these other stories, but in a little bit more of a nuanced way. And I think that's sort of another reason why I feel this queerness within those archetypes, because we're also seeing these sort of classical gay relationship roles, you know, these heteronormative roles that we often fall into or want to fall into. Mm-hmm. And often that means one partner is the dominant partner and one partner is submissive. Mm-hmm. And I see it here and I just find it so interesting. And yeah, antiques. Gays love antiques.
Yeah.
And why not?
Yeah. Well, and what I think is interesting, what I love so much about Fright, I mean, there are a million things I love about Fright Night. It's one of my all-time favorite movies. But what I love about Straker that I don't necessarily like so much about Renfield is that I feel like Straker is a human being, you know, and Renfield, he is human, but he's so monstrous. Like the way he is portrayed, he doesn't have, I feel like, a life. You know, he has completely devoted his life to Dracula. And I feel like Straker, like he is a character that feels like a complete character, even though he is devoted to Dracula.
I agree with you.
Dracula, you know?
Yeah, Renfield is very cartoonish with the spiders and the like silly, like, old-timey insanity portrayal.
Yeah.
But did you see Renfield?
I did see Renfield, and I thought it was fun. I love Nicholas Holt, and I love a good sweater on a beautiful man, so that was fun. Yes. And I love arms ripped off, so.
There was a shocking amount of gore and poop.
I know, and I was here for it. I was like, okay.
It was fun. I wasn't bored for a second, and honestly, that's all I'm really asking from film, so. Same. So before we move on into, you know, other variations of the story, I mean, do we have any final thoughts on the novel? Are there any important plots or characters that I'm missing?
Okay, well, there's one. So you said that Bonnie, that story is the one that stuck with you. The one that has stuck with me is this young couple with their baby. Mm-hmm. And she gets pregnant in high school and gets stuck married to this guy. And they cannot stand each other. They live in pretty dire poverty. It sounds like she's miserable. There's a hint. There's not a hint. Like she abuses the baby and then the baby dies. And it's really upsetting. But I also think two of maybe the scariest scenes King has ever written are in this book. And it is the scene where Danny and his brother are walking home through the dark and they think there's something behind him. And the scene where Matt and Susan are sitting in his kitchen and Mike Ryerson is asleep upstairs. Or no, he was asleep the night before, but he's like, I hear something upstairs. I know my house. I know what board that was. And he walks upstairs and he has a heart attack. And those scenes are nightmare fuel. They are terrifying because of what you don't see. And it is just masterful horror writing.
Oh, it's so spooky. Mm-hmm. And it's so gothic. And it's so small town moody in a way that I'm always kind of looking for. And I think it's because of Stephen King.
Absolutely.
On some level.
It's like the perfect October book too.
Oh, it's such a good October book. Mm-hmm. I just saw like the perfect October movie and I don't think enough people are talking about it. Have you seen Cobweb yet?
I was wondering if that's what you're going to say. Yes, I did see Cobweb and I loved it.
Holy shit.
Oh my God. I'm a huge Anthony Starr fan too. And he's so good in this. And yeah, like, why did they release this in July?
I don't know. It's very Halloween resurrection of them. I don't know why they did it.
I'm hoping people will discover it in October.
Oh, it's so, and like, there's, they just have like these big rotting carcasses of pumpkins in their backyard for no reason. And it's just gorgeous. It's I love that movie.
I love
perfect,
it.
Perfect October nonsense.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So if it's great with you, let's move on quickly into the mini series because, it's fascinating. I rewatched it today. It's on my mind. So the miniseries came out in 1979. It was a two-parter directed by horror icon Tobe Hooper, the director of the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, which is like a very interesting choice for this film. But that actually, I think, was just 5 years or so before this. So it makes sense timing-wise. They made this for about $4 million, and it aired on CBS. It starred David Soul and James Mason. It was pretty well received. I think it got like a bunch of primetime Emmy nominations for makeup, title, and music. How did we feel about this miniseries, and when did we first encounter it? I'll start with you.
Well, I first encountered it when I began really actively engaging in the horror community and talking about Stephen King. Because there are some iconic scenes in this miniseries. I first watched it on Friday. I had not seen the whole thing all the way through.
Until then,
I swear I thought it was John Voight who was playing Ben Mears, his blonde hair. I just have Midnight Cowboy John Voight in my head, you know, or maybe Deliverance John Voight. But it's not. It's like I don't know, the John Voight we have at home who starts in it. And it's fine. I think, so I first like actually watched the whole thing over the course of this weekend. And I found it, I was into it. I thought it did some interesting things. And I think Tobe Hooper's eye here brings a level of like, I don't know, revulsion horror that I really like. I think it kind of dirties up the story and adds a little grit to it, you know, in a way that I don't think a lot of television, especially at that time, would have been able to do.
Yeah, it is very 70s. Like, it's just so aggressively 70s. And, you know, I like to joke that I believe culture sort of began in 1978 with Halloween, and everything before that was just like the void of space, and I don't believe that it exists. And as I get older, the less I actually feel that, and I can sort of open my heart up to things that are a little bit more vintage. But it's just so funny how like we were so comfortable putting old men on screen back then in a way that we won't do anymore. Just old grizzled men.
Yeah.
And
the changeling.
Oh yeah, exactly. And I kind of respect it, but it's so funny how like, yeah, this is just like a bunch of tough, old, unattractive dudes, and it's so funny. And the women are so mousy. Like, it's just it's so 70s and funny. Oh my God, and Fred Willard is there. He's the character that we were talking about earlier that gets the gun pointed at him. And that was so funny to see. But there are some really effective moments. There's that like really famous moment of the Glick boy sort of floating at the window. There's the scene that I remember being a lot scarier where Barlow bursts into the kitchen and then like smacks their head like coconuts, which in the book is scary, but in the miniseries it's so bad.
Oh, I know. It's like, please don't actually hurt yourselves when you bump. We're going as close as possibly can.
It is terrifying
in the book, though.
In the book, I was like, their heads exploded. And then the movie, that's like, and then it's not very scary. But Barlow's beautiful. Like, Barlow looks terrifying and real. So,
yeah, I think of the things that have lasted with this miniseries are the look of the Marston house. Like, the interior of it is so gross and like, it feels like a fancy version of the Texas Chainsaw Massacre house. You know, you
totally
smell it. And, oh, sorry.
That's okay.
And then also there's Danny Glick at the window with all of the smoke behind him, which is so creepy. And then there's the look of Barlow. And I think those are the enduring things. And, you know, it was inspired by Max Schreck's Nosferatu, but it also, I think, has gone on to also inspire vampire design too. Like if you look at The Last Voyage of the Demeter, there's a lot of nods to, I think, Tobe Hooper's Salem's Lot in the design of Dracula there too.
Yeah, definitely. It's pretty iconic. It's, you know, for 3 hours long, I don't find it boring at all.
Yeah,
and that's really important to me. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just a little bit dated, and it's just like, when I was rewatching it recently, I was like, wow, I don't always get excited at the idea of like a reboot or a remake, but just like with It a few years ago, like, I feel like this is one that we could really use. Mm-hmm. You know, we never had a big like theatrical It before, even though the miniseries is so strong. And I kind of think that there's such a strong parallel between what happened there and what could happen here with Salem's Lot.
Mm-hmm.
But that said, there are other iterations before we get into the upcoming film that I know you probably have a little bit more insight into. Mm-hmm. There was a sequel film in 1987 called A Return to Salem's Lot that everybody really hates. But yep. I also discovered recently had its world premiere at the Cannes Film Festival, which is so funny.
Whoa.
Yeah. Like maybe they were less prestigious in the 80s. I don't know what's happening.
Yeah. Who knows? I mean, I don't know. Stephen King's name carries a lot of weight in very strange directions.
Yes.
You know? That I have not seen Return to Salem's Lot, although we have the Losers Club, we have an episode, and we have some defenders of it because I do think it is, I don't know if I would call it so bad it's good, but there's a lot of very interesting gems to mine in that. So if you want to hear a defense of Return to Salem's Lot, check out that episode.
I would. And I think, again, this was us talking offline, but I'm like a little bit obsessed with lost Stephen King adaptations that people just don't give a shit about. Like, we're about to talk about the 2004 miniseries, but, you know, what Returns to Salem's Lot, it's a big one. The trilogy of Sometimes They Come Back, like, there are three of those.
Yes, loved them. They were on USA all the time when I was a kid.
Yeah.
Their titles are gold. It's like, Sometimes They Come Back Again, Sometimes They Come Back For More. It's just
it's so great. Good.
It's like Elaine shouting, like, top of the muffin to you.
I just remember the second one, which I think was direct-to-video, but I don't know. And I remember, like, the wall of horror VHSs at the video store that you have to, like, really prep yourself to turn it over to, like, see the scary stuff on the back. And the back art of Sometimes They Come Back Again, I think, in my head, into the outer space. So,
and isn't it so funny, those VHS ones, you remember? Because, like, I looked at... what is it? Dead Alive? The one where he's like pulling the mouth open. Yeah.
That's fucked.
That and Texas Chainsaw Massacre. And I remember looking at her on the hook and like just staring at it and trying to wrap my brain around what was going to happen in this movie. And for years, like I didn't watch that until I was an adult because I was so scared by that VHS cover.
That movie's fucking scary.
It really is. A masterpiece, but also terrifying.
You know what else was like a classic? Don't turn over the VHS, it's too scary. Was The Mutilator or just Mutilator?
Oh, yeah.
Do you remember that one?
That's the one with the little boy, right?
And no, it's another lady hanging on a hook.
Oh, yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think the tagline is like, by hook, by axe, by pick, bye bye.
Oh, my gosh. Okay, well, my other one is Pet Sematary 2, the drill and the no brain, no pain. I was like, oh my God, this is going to be too much for me. I can't watch it.
Justice for Pet Sematary 2.
Oh my gosh, yes. Other than that mashed potato scene. Yes, that
I don't remember the mashed potato scene. Remind me.
Oh, he spits mashed potatoes out. That's my kryptonite to spit out food. I cannot handle it. But
yeah, yuck. So food is not to be played with.
Exactly. That is a rule to live by.
right? Okay, I haven't seen this 2004 miniseries. My note says Jen takes the lead here, so
okay.
I'm throwing to you.
All right, yes, I have seen it. I remember being excited about this because I had read the book and loved the book. And I was very much in my, I read the book and this is how it happens in the book phase of my life. I've since like relaxed, and I'm often very delighted when an adaptation goes a different direction than the source material. But back then I was like, that's not my film. But anyways, I was very excited about this. I was a heavy TNT watcher at the time because they had all those SVU reruns. This was the era of TiVo. This was the era of me. This is more just about me and the miniseries. But yeah, I was dating this guy, and I remember I got like one of our dates was to watch this on my TiVo. And I think it was that night or pretty soon after, I just was like, this isn't going to work out. But we were supposed to watch the second episode. And I just kept putting him off and putting him off and putting him off. And finally, like, I think I didn't watch the second episode for like a month later because I was like,
the baggage.
I know. Yeah. But then I did finally watch it. And it is interesting. I think it's got some strengths.
Wait. How did the breakup go though?
So first of all, like, we had never actually committed, so we didn't actually have to break up.
Sure.
I did not ghost him, for the record, but I just kept kind of putting it off and was like, I don't think this is good. Like, he eventually just kind of read the writing on the wall and I think watched Salem's Lot by himself. When we finally both admitted that we had watched the second episode, I think that's when we realized the relationship was never gonna
wow, happen. I like that. So, that's strong.
Yeah.
Interesting. So yeah, how does it stack up?
It's like you said, it's a forgotten adaptation, I think. A lot of it because of the TNT-ness of it. You know, it's 2004. It's before we really got to the golden age of television. It's kind of right before, but they put a lot of money into this. Mm-hmm. And it's very well cast. I think that is the strength. It was a two-part miniseries, debuted on June 20th, and the second episode ran June 21st, although not in my house. It was weeks after. But the casting, I think, is the strongest part of this. And this is still what I picture these characters as, a lot of these characters as, when I read the book. So we've got Rob Lowe as Ben Mears, which I think is good. I think that makes that character interesting, although I still see John Boyd in my head. It's got Samantha Mathis as Susan Norton. And like the book, I think those two are the least interesting.
Who's Samantha Mathis?
Mathis is Patrick Bateman's side piece in American Psycho. And also Pump Up the Volume. She was in Under the Dome. Claim to fame. She's also in the new Pet Sematary Bloodline. So she's got a little bit of King cred too. But yeah, she's one of those you would recognize her if you saw her. She's Susan Norton. As Barlow, I'm going to go to Straker first. So Donald Sutherland is Richard Straker, which I love. And Rutger Hauer is Kurt Barlow. So dream casting for these two roles. You know? And Rutger Hauer is one of those, he carries this aura of menace with him. So just hearing that he was cast as Barlow is like, oh, this is scary. You know?
Are you aware of what happened with him on set? The infamous?
Yeah. Did you read that quote from Rob Lowe about his monologue?
Can you tell us about that?
I watched St. Elmo's Fire. I was a big fan of that movie, although I don't think it's held up so well. I also didn't totally understand what was happening in it. But that's when I found him, as kind of adjacent to the Brat Pack. But Parks and Rec and West Wing is when I really fell in love with him.
Time he hosted the Oscars with Snow White.
Yes. I just love that he will just do anything. He will say yes. And I love that he I feel like he'll make fun of himself and he doesn't take himself too seriously.
100%.
Like anybody who plays Chris Traeger, I think. Can't take yourself too seriously. Okay, so here is the quote. I thought I had it. Now here it is.
Take your time.
Okay, Lowe said, "I once starred in a big miniseries that culminated with the villain giving a 2-page monologue trying to goad me into killing him. The actor playing the bad guy wanted to ad-lib his own version of the movie-ending speech." So the actor is obviously Rutger Hauer. Which is giving me a little bit of Marlon Brando on Superman vibes. I don't need to memorize my lines. Don't you know who I am? Although I love Rutger Hauer, I would never besmirch him. Okay, back to the quote. Although he was playing a vampire, not really trying to hide
no.
He went on a soliloquy about being a cowboy. The director was not impressed. After a very tense negotiation, the actor was forced to shit-can his self-penned opus and stick to the original script. There was only one problem. He hadn't bothered to learn it. Lowe went on to state that cue cards were placed next to his head and Hauer read the lines to him, which just...
What a lunatic.
I
celebrate
know.
It. I celebrate the lunacy right there.
I do too. And he's great in this. I think he, you know, it's hard for, I think, Rutger Hauer to be bad in anything because he's just amazing.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I think he's pretty good in this role. And I think that is just dream casting for those. But here's where the best casting of this miniseries, I think, is James Cromwell as Father Callahan.
Oh, like, super good, yeah.
Exactly. Like, I picture, and that's one of the things I do not like about the original miniseries, is a lot of the casting of the side characters I don't like. Like, he's this tall, menacing character. It's like he's bringing a lot of his L.A. Confidential vibes to it, you know? Mm-hmm. And that's what I see. I always see him as Father Callahan. And we also have Andre Brower as Matt Burke, which I also think is perfect for that role. Huge fan mm-hmm. of Andre Brower. Have you watched Brooklyn Nine-Nine?
Oh, of course.
He's so fantastic in that show. Yeah. One thing that is interesting about the 2004 is it makes some interesting changes to the subject material or to the source material. So we have, there is no Miranda, unless I'm forgetting something. There is no Miranda. So he is brought back to the house. He did not see, as a child, Ben, I'm talking about, sorry, mm-hmm. I'm talking in circles. Ben did not see Hubie hanging from the banister. He saw one of Hubie's child murders. And so earlier I was talking about how they hinted at some kind of pedophilia murdering thing, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And we see like a child in the bathtub, like fetal position. It's a little upsetting. Although, you know, TNT level, like darkness, you know. But so that, and Ben hears this voice as a kid and does not go save him. And so this guilt for not saving this child has been haunting him the whole time. And so that is what's drawn him back. And I wonder if they, I don't know, we're just trying to update the story a little bit. It feels kind of like an unnecessary change.
No, I like it. Because, like, why are you back in town? Because the house is haunted? Like,
yeah.
I like that, but, like, it's pretty nonsense.
Exactly, yeah. You want to write a book about this town? It's very, like, I don't know, Jack wanting to write about the Overlook, except he was already at the Overlook, and that's why. You know, but Ben just kind of remembers this thing. But another really interesting thing, change that they make, is with the wraparound. So they don't go to Mexico. The beginning and end of Salem's Lot starts, the novel and the old miniseries starts with the survivors, who I will not name to not spoil a, what, 40-year-old book. They have escaped to Mexico and they're remembering the horrors they've seen and they go back to Salem's Lot and the whole story is told through a flashback. So the 2004 nixes that and it starts with Ben Mears attacking Father Callahan in a homeless shelter in Detroit on Thanksgiving. So that's how it starts. There's a whole hospital scene. There's Matt Burke in peril in the hospital. But what's interesting about this is how it relates to the Dark Tower. Now, are you a Dark Tower head? Have you read any of the Dark Tower?
I haven't read it yet. I'm very familiar with it, but yeah. I'm just like intimidated.
I don't love the Dark Tower.
Oh, whoa.
I know, blasphemy in this.
Blew my mind.
I am glad. I've read them all, and I'm glad I've read them all, and I love the ending. But, like, on the Losers Club, I am one of I don't volunteer for the Dark Tower episodes because we have a lot of people who are really into it. I'm just not a big fantasy fan. Anyways.
Mm-hmm. Me too.
So I'm not going to say too much about this that's going to spoil anything because this would be a major spoiler. But Wolves of the Calla, which is the Dark Tower 5 novel, was released in November 2003. And there is a connection to a homeless shelter and an unhoused shelter, I should say now,
mm-hmm.
And Father Callahan. And I think that's a really interesting change to make with this coming out in 2004. I don't know how intentional it was, but it does not feel like a coincidence to me.
Cool. I love like that kind of shit in the Kingverse.
Oh, yeah. And this Callahan is a really in a city. Fun example of it, too.
Did Callahan like become a vampire and go to New York in the book, or did I make that
he
up?
He does, yeah. That's what happens in Wolves of the Cala. He reappears in the story, and he is like helping or dealing with unhoused people and living in a shelter in New York City. And just doesn't that feel too close to be a coincidence for them to make?
No,
that
that's thing? For sure real.
That's yeah.
And I love that. Okay, fascinating.
I
do too.
I think it's interesting.
Gotta watch it.
I did not like that when I first watched it. I was like, what are they doing? This is weird. But now that I've read Wolves of the Cala, which I will say is my third favorite Dark Tower book. So
I have tried The Gunslinger like 5 times, and 5 times I have put it down.
I don't like The Gunslinger. If you listen to the audiobook, it will keep going even if you lose interest. But
it's kind of the whole thesis of The Dark Tower.
Yeah.
No, it's not.
Well, it is, but I will say the second book is my favorite. Like The Drawing of the Three, I've never been more surprised by how much I loved it.
I just want it to be scary. When is it going to get scary?
It's more action scary in the second one, but the whole thing is not really super scary.
But I like the Lovecrafty stuff. Like the idea of the Crimson King seems cool.
Yeah, that is cool. Have you read Insomnia?
No, but I'm aware that there's a crossover
There's a crossover there.
Was the Crimson King that's the crossover with Insomnia? I knew Dark Tower. I didn't know it was Crimson, Mr. Red, Big Red.
Yes. Yes, there's a Dark Tower reference with the Crimson King at the end of Insomnia. And it's one of the earliest references, I think, of the Crimson King, where we get some details too. So it's one of those things that King just kind of drops in and you're like, oh, holy shit, this is a Dark Tower novel. Okay. Now we're cooking on that mouse. But, Wolves of the Cala, I love, it's got a little bit of Lovecrafty stuff. There's a lot of that in the last 3 of them. But I just get really lost in what's going on with the fantasy. I have a hard time wrapping
my head around. Fantasy is boring. I recently read the Eyes of the Dragon.
Oh, Eyes of the Dragon. Yeah.
So I was like, okay.
Okay. Bronson Pinchot reads the audiobook, and that's what makes that good.
Okay.
So I listened to that, and it's not bad. If you're not a completist and you weren't that into The Gunslinger, I would say if you really want to, give The Drawing of the Three a try because it's great.
Okay.
But if not, if you don't care about reading them all, then I would say don't worry about it.
I will get there. Yeah. Will it be in 50 years from now? Probably. And that's okay. I celebrate that for me.
Absolutely. It'll call you when it's time, you know?
I'm sorry for holding you hostage, but I do love when he goes full Lovecraft. I just read Revival.
Oh, it's so good. The ending?
The ending of Revival, everybody's going to ruin your life.
Oh, yeah. I read that on maternity leave.
No.
I know.
That's bad. So I love that. Good. It's like when I read The Jaunt the first time I took a plane by myself.
Oh, gosh.
That was not good.
Did you get out and like...
I'm still there. I'm still on that plane.
God, you're still in the middle. What if this whole thing was just like your life inside The Jaunt?
I love The Jaunt. The Jaunt's probably my favorite thing he's ever done.
It's one of the best short stories I think anyone's ever written. It's so good.
And we have an episode on Development Hell all about that movie/TV show. That what's going on? Okay, I don't want to hold you hostage forever. For partial forever. So if it's okay with you, maybe we can jump in to what the fuck is going on with this movie.
Absolutely. Also, please never apologize for talking to me longer about Stephen King.
Okay.
I'll go forever. I really will.
Oh my God. It's an eternity in there. It is.
Oh, I love that.
I was excited back in 2019. When it was announced we were going to get like a big puffy theatrical adaptation of Salem's Lot. Mm-hmm. It felt very post the It films that we got in 2 parts that were sort of big popcorn movies, and they were like 2 of the most successful horror movies of all time, also at Warner Brothers / New Line. So it made a lot of sense when New Line Warner Brothers announced they were going to do sort of the same thing with Salem's Lot that had never actually had a theatrical movie. Mm-hmm. And they reported, I'm going to scratch that. And then the Hollywood Reporter revealed that Gary Dauberman was set to write the screenplay and that James Wan was going to produce. Dauberman is known for writing It Chapter 2. We say that he also wrote It Chapter 1, but there was other creatives involved there that I think really helped things. Mm-hmm. He wrote all the Annabelle movies. He wrote The Nun, and he directed Annabelle Comes Home. And I have feelings about him as a creative, which we'll get to in just a second. But then in 2020, it was announced that he was going to direct as well. So this would be his second directorial effort after Annabelle Comes Home. Fans of this podcast might remember he was also attached to make the Are You Afraid of the Dark movie that fell through the cracks. And I think that could have been interesting. Let's talk about Gary for a second here. I think he gets a lot of flack, and I think that it's kind of deserved in some cases. But I am an Annabelle 2 and 3 apologist, personally.
I am too. I love them. There are parts of Annabelle, the original, that I enjoy.
Sure.
Although I don't think it is a successful movie, you know? Mm-hmm. But there are some creepy sequences. But yeah, Annabelle 2 and Annabelle 3. And I believe, I'm thinking Ouija Origin of Evil. That's Mike Flanagan.
Mm-hmm. But I get how you're bringing that in.
Yeah,
totally.
Yeah.
I see that.
But I like Annabelle Comes Home. I think it's fun, you know?
So fun.
It's like a fun house, spooky stuff around every corner kind of movie. And I think it's very well executed. I have other thoughts about him as a writer. You know, I think there was a marked decline in It Chapter 1 to It Chapter 2, even though I do like It Chapter 2. I'm one of the defenders on the
book. Wow. But, no, I respect it. It Chapter 2 has some things going for it, but it certainly is no It Chapter 1.
Absolutely.
And I think the Cary Fukunaga of it all, in my opinion, even though what do I know, has a lot to do with that. And
I
we did an episode.
Exactly right.
Yeah. So I think he's kind of what brought that special spark to the first one.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Gary Dauberman is kind of, in my opinion, I think maybe those movies succeed in spite of him, maybe.
Yes. Yes. I agree. Yeah.
Okay. But, you know.
Well, and there's an element of that in the Conjuring universe, too, that I feel like.
Oh, yeah. He wrote The Nun.
Amplified. And now, I mean, I will excuse it with The Nun because it's about a nun.
Yeah.
But,
yeah.
Like, every Conjuring movie I watch, and I, you know, I'm saying this to the universe larger aside from him, but like it just keeps getting into this like Christian good, evil, everything else thing.
So boring. Did you see The Nun too?
I did. Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
I thought it was dumb and fun. I kind of equate it to The Meg too. You know.
Okay, I'm dying to see The Meg too. Personally,
The Meg has a giant octopus.
So I gotta see The Meg. Fun. I hated The Nun 2. I'm so sorry.
Oh, you did?
Yeah, I just couldn't. But you know what? I respect you and your opinions.
Oh,
and
it's
very cool.
I just like seeing shit get on fire, and I don't know. Okay. I need more hot people in it, though.
Oh yeah, and like Storm Reid, very lovely, very talented, but there's just no way that girl wasn't alive during the 2008 financial crisis. So I just like don't
absolutely
believe.
Yes, like shoehorn a character in.
Yeah, like, that's not the 50s at
no,
all.
No,
but that's okay. Yeah, so Dauberman, I think that he's like an interesting choice. I think that there is some red flags and some, I guess, green flags that make him someone that I'm very curious to see what he would do with this film. He was asked in an interview if he would take the same approach to writing this film that he did with It Chapter 1 and It Chapter 2. Do you have the outline? Because I kind of want to make you read it.
Yeah, I do.
Do you want to give us your best Gary Dauberman
best
impression?
Gary Dauberman, yes.
Yeah.
Okay, in an interview he was asked, hold on.
Take your time.
Okay, so this is Gary Dauberman saying, I like to be as true to the story as I possibly can until it gets a little too unwieldy for a movie. I'm very, very excited to be a part of that and to tackle it. It hasn't had the big screen treatment yet, which is how I felt about it. It's so fun to play around with vampires and make something truly scary. I haven't seen that in a long, long time, and I'm excited for people to see it.
So okay, Gary. Work, Gary, work. Sure, why not? In 2021, it was announced some of the cast came to light. So we've got Lewis Pullman, who people might remember as a character from Top Gun Maverick, which of course I didn't see, but I hear it was great.
Yeah. And Bill Pullman's son also, who
is very important.
A person I have a huge crush on. So
Bill Pullman, not Bill Pullman's son.
Bill Pullman, yeah. Bill Pullman's son, he's fine. I'm sure I'll probably have a crush on him eventually.
He seems like an interesting kind of like a safe choice for this in a way that I'm like, that's not shade. Like, it seems like a good, safe choice. So he's
he's playing Ben Mears too. So like,
yeah, exactly. Well, that's why like safe.
Yeah. Yeah.
We also have Mackenzie Lee as Susan. I don't really know much about her. And William Sadler, who's like a very famous character actor in an unreported role, but like, it's going to be Barlow, I think.
Yeah.
Are you familiar with Sadler?
I was about to look him up.
He's a guy that is in stuff.
Hold on. Who's going to be Barlow?
They don't say.
I don't want him to be Barlow. I've seen it reported that he might be Parkins Gillespie.
Oh, okay. So I'm
inside out and upside down. But they haven't. Let's see if it says anything. I do not like him for Barlow.
Interesting. Okay, so I take it back. I'm full of you know what.
No, you're not. I mean, yeah, you might be right.
No, I am. You just don't know it yet. So we've got a cast. We've got a bunch of people. They seem very capable and lovely. Yeah. So they shot this film in September, I think, of 2021 in Boston. And there were some cute set photos that we published on Dread Central. We got a cute little look at the build of the Marston's house, and it looks very gothic and lovely. Mm-hmm. And that's when everything was good and dandy. Come 2022, there were reports surfacing online of reshoots, and allegedly some of these... Okay, so this is all very alleged. I don't want to get sued by Gary Dauberman. But we got some, at Dread Central, we got these like reports that there were these postings for crew for some like serious reshoots for this film where no director was listed in like a very non-traditional way. So that like raised a bunch of flags for us, but there just wasn't enough information on that to publish anything. So this is all very alleged pie, but I find that very interesting now that it's been so delayed.
Yeah.
There were reshoots, so that was confirmed by Deadline. And they also announced that the date was pushed from September 9th to April 21st, 2023. And so that's like a huge jump. And the reasons were supposedly due to COVID-related delays in the post-production of it all. Mm-hmm. In August of 2022, they reported that this film was taken off the calendar from April 21st, 2023 to just to be determined the next year, and that it was, you know, still being blamed on post-production issues. Then something really interesting happened. Evil Dead Rise, which was not even supposed to go into theaters, it was supposed to go directly on Max, took its slot. So it took the Salem's Lot slot of April 21st in 2023, and it did huge numbers. It was a massive success, I think partially because it was just so good.
Yeah.
I mean, I liked it.
I did too. I loved it. I thought it was fun.
Yeah. And then that was kind of it until about 2 weeks ago when, I don't know, this is another alleged thing. I think this is official, but it could not be true, where this alleged Warner Brothers slate of films surfaced online stating all of their upcoming films, and it did list Salem's Lot as to be announced for 2024. Mm-hmm. So there's some hope there, but this is the same studio that completely scrapped a huge budgeted film, Batgirl, just like off the face of the planet. Mm-hmm. So who's to say they couldn't do that to Salem's Lot? Jen, what is going on?
I don't know. I mean, we have been following this down at Losers Club headquarters. We've been following this production hell and can't quite get a read on what exactly is happening. Because like you said, like we've seen things get pushed back before, you know, and we've seen not so great remakes just kind of given to us, you know, looking at Firestarter. Mm-hmm. Although there are 30 minutes of Firestarter that I will defend with my life. But yeah, it's just really, it reeks of a lot of problems. And I blame Dauberman for a lot of that. I don't know if I trust him to handle this story.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder if it got a little unwieldy. Like, even reading that quote, like, to say that nobody's been playing around with vampires, that we've had a lot of vampire stuff recently. Also, mm-hmm. I don't want him to play around with vampires in this story. I want him to give me Salem's Lot. I am okay with some changes, but, like, the vampires for Salem's Lot are, like, only half the story. The other half is the town. And when I look at something like Annabelle Comes Home, which I loved, that is a very simple, very contained story. It is essentially house has lots of spooky shit in it. And there is this dad dead trauma, you know. And I think he executes it very well. But Salem's Lot is a lot more sprawling. There are a lot more characters to keep track of. There are a lot more things that you have to manage. And I wonder if, like, this just kind of became a mess. Like, I don't know how many people want to see a Salem's Lot inspired vampire story that doesn't look like Salem's Lot, because that's just vampire movies. You know, mm-hmm. Salem's Lot has inspired so much of the modern vampire stuff that we have now that, like, what's going to separate this from any other vampire movie? I also think it is very troubling, I think, that we don't know or we haven't seen Barlow, you know, like your big villain. Like, I remember when it was coming out and we saw, you know, Bill Skarsgård as Pennywise and we saw the makeup and we saw it, like, that gets you excited about this. And, mm-hmm. you know, I think if William Sadler is going to be Barlow, you know, I think he's a great actor. He's done a lot of King stuff. I think he can do it. And I think he'd be great. But it just makes me really nervous that we haven't seen anything from it. And that reeks to me of massive structural problems that I don't know if simple reshoots can fix.
Yeah. I agree with you totally. And if they do keep sort of ringing the alarm of post-production issues, uh-huh. like, is that, like, the CGI is bad? Like, the villain looks bad? Like, what is that? What does that mean?
Right. It means, what do we have here? You know, mm-hmm. we've got this image that is on a King Tyan novel, which I think looks great. I think sure. this image of, like, the blue kind of cloudiness, it looks great, although it does look a lot like the Stand, Stand remake imagery, you know. Yeah. Although I love that it's got a Skarsgård in it. I mean, I could talk.
Wow, a lot of Skarsgård and King.
Exactly. Yeah. Another topic I could talk about for an extended amount of time, because I love them. I do like that this one has Spencer Treat Clark in it. Have you seen that casting?
I did. He's spooky. He is. Have you seen the remake of
The Town of Dread Sundown?
Yes.
I have, for him, because he's an OG crush for me.
Oh, really? I love that for you.
He's an unsung hottie. I want
he's
more
so cute.
Yeah, he's so sweet.
I love that movie in a way.
I do too. Yeah.
He's so tragic with those doe eyes. So.
Yeah. He's also in The Last House on the Left remake, I think.
Oh, my God. That is right. Another perfect character for him.
I agree. Yeah.
And a bit of a King crossover there, because I'm pretty sure King is on record saying that that's, like, the best modern horror movie of all time or something.
It's either in the update or the original run of On Writing, I think, where he talks about that being one of the best or scariest movies, which, I mean, I don't disagree with him. I don't love that movie, sure. but it's got some moments, you know.
We're
a good head in a microwave, you know.
Yeah. And it had a really good cover of Sweet Child of Mine in the trailer. I really recommend everyone looking that up, because it's cool.
I'm going to look that up, because I have not seen that trailer.
Yeah, by a band, Taken by Trees. It was a big part of my undergraduate experience. lots of red flags, yep. a lot of concern, a lot of smoke where fire may be. Mm. So,
I mean, how can it not be fire, you know?
It smells like fire for sure. Mm-hmm. But don't we just want to have hope?
I do want to have hope. And, you know, like I mentioned the Firestarter remake, which, again, first 30 minutes, I love the first 30 minutes of that movie. I will watch it. I had a fun time with the new Children of the Corn, you know?
Like, I did too. I did too.
There's a little redheaded girl that is starting shit and killing people.
Okay, she is an icon. She did nothing wrong.
Yes, exactly. Like, she's my queen. I love her.
I love her. Wow, no, it's so hard to get someone to agree with me on that one.
I'm glad I found you. I will agree with you. I mean, that movie, it's not perfect. It's got some problems, but I had a blast with it.
When they bury all the adults.
Exactly, yes. And I love how she just like nonchalantly like leading this horse that's strangling the dude. Anyways, yes, check that movie out. It's well worth your time.
Yeah. And,
like, it's either going to be a big old mess or it's going to be great. Maybe it'll surprise us and it will be the next at chapter one. I don't think it will, but.
I'm begging for it to be. And I don't need a lot to be happy. Like, you know, I'm not that difficult of a customer. I just want Salem's. Lot.
Yeah. Just give me some fun vampires. Give me that. Give me a town that knows darkness and I'm happy, you know?
Okay, I'm gonna bring something up and if you haven't seen it, I'll feel bad. But there has been a new project in recent days that I think really captures the horror of Salem's Lot in a way. It's the TV show From.
I have not seen it, but I have heard it's so good. I didn't know it was vampires.
Okay, no, it's not.
Oh,
I'm not saying what it is. I'm not saying what it is.
Okay.
But it's very Salem's Lot in its oeuvre and energy. And I'm going to say it's maybe the scariest, such a big thing to say, but maybe the scariest TV show I've ever seen. And Stephen King is obsessed with it.
Really? I did know that. That is why it's on my radar. And it's got Harold Perrineau in it, right?
Yes. Yes.
I love. He will always be my Mercutio. And I always want to like scream "Walt!" whenever I see.
He's so iconic. I got to interview him at Dread Central for 5 minutes, and it was really life changing for me.
Oh my god, I would die! I love him.
But it is so good and so scary and so weird, and it really captures the like small town stressful horror of Salem's Lot in a way that I don't think I've ever seen before.
Ooh, okay. And now, how can I watch it? Because I'm really wanting to watch it.
Oh, that's the tough thing. So it's MGM Plus, whatever that means. I think it might be on Amazon Prime, though.
Okay. Oh, I can. Let me see if I can just watch
it. I'm in Canada, though, so what do I know?
Oh, are you? Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, hello. From Canada.
Mm-hmm. Hi.
Sorry. I don't know why I got really weird.
No, it's Canadian. You cannot trust Canadians, okay?
Hey,
don't.
Y'all shouldn't trust Americans, honestly.
Oh, no, we don't. We don't.
Yeah. That's smart of you. Okay, I'll figure out how to watch From. Because I was interested in it because I've heard it's really good.
I couldn't recommend it higher. It's like I'm ringing the From bell
all the time. It just skyrocketed up. Have you seen Marianne?
Okay, I haven't, but I'm very, very upset that I haven't because it looks fucking scary.
It did. I really was terrified by it too. It's also the director of Cobweb.
I know.
So similar vibes. Yeah. Okay. Well, we're gonna have to trade shows.
Okay, so we're gonna have to trade off.
Yeah.
I 100% will watch Marianne. I've been desperately meaning to, and that's an easy one because it's Newt Flukes.
I've been dying to watch. It's very accessible. I've been dying to watch From, so I'm excited.
You have to. I know, and it has such a stupid title, so like that doesn't work for it.
Yeah, I just tried to From watch or just
watch
like
it. How do you Google that? You can't. every once in a while, I try to find our articles on it. And I'll just Google like Dread Central From, and it doesn't work.
And you get every single article with the word From in it.
Google's like, shut the fuck up.
Right, they might as well have named it V or something.
yeah, it's bad. It's like You, show You. Yeah. It's like, can you as a journalist, like the SEO. Nonsense there really hurts my heart.
Oh, I feel the same way about Scream and the titles. And I mean, I could go on a whole soapbox.
Oh, the fact that they
Wolverine,
went from
the Wolverine.
Oh. I like when things go from the to not the. I like that actually. But the fact that we went from Scream 4 to Scream 6, I wake up every day screaming.
Yeah.
In a cold sweat. I'm just like, no, it's real.
No pun intended. Yeah, we call it 5 Cream.
Yeah. I had really good suggestions for Scream 6 that they didn't take, including Scream Plus, which I really like.
Ooh.
Mm-hmm. Scream XR, like an iPhone.
Ooh, I like that. What's the next
Scream? That was
a Twitter commentary.
yeah.
My suggestion for Scream 6 was for Stu to be the murderer. They didn't take
that. Oh, that's so good. Okay, can I tell you my pitch for Scream 7?
Yes, please.
Okay, it's pretty, like, obvious, so I apologize, but I stand by it. So, obviously, like, it's the meta franchise. So let's take it into our world, where all of the actors that have been in Scream movies are starting to get targeted and get killed one by one, and we can have another Drew Barrymore opening kill.
Watch that in a heartbeat. Yes,
are you sure you don't hate it?
No, I love it because it's like three, but like more, you know? And three is, you know, it's not all bad. There's a lot of great stuff in there.
Right?
Those bangs are even growing on me, you know?
I mean, Scream 3 is, I love Scream 3. I literally watched Scream 3 like 2 days ago.
It's such a great, like, background hangover movie, you know?
Oh, for sure. It's the most comforting, least frightening movie ever made, and I love it so much. So,
and the ending is perfect. That is Sydney's ending forever for me.
I mean, like, what is even happening in that ending? But I do love it. I love it.
Oh, so good. The door, I would cry.
That is all the information I personally have found on Salem's Lot 2020 ? Hopefully 2024. So I'm going to take us into conclusions territory, and I'm going to ask you, because you are, you know, you're Hollywood, you're in charge, you're an executive. Are we going to see Salem's Lot in 2024?
I think that we will. I think that King is too valuable of a name, and it is too valuable of a property for us not to see it.
Is it as valuable as Batgirl?
I think it might be. I mean, I don't know. I'm a bad, like, for me, who likes horror and doesn't care so much about comics. Although I do like girls and them being
involved. Luckily the word girl isn't in this title, so maybe that'll help things.
Salem's Lot Girl.
I would watch Salem's Lot Girl immediately.
I would too, but you know they would never give it to us.
No.
But yeah, I have heard rumblings that they are still tinkering with some things, and that the 2024 October, I think, is
far.
I know. Hey, which leaves them plenty of time to get their shit together and give us a
get it to fucking gather, people.
Right. One job.
I need this movie. I need more King. We go through these ebbs and flows of King, like movie eras, and I want to be back in it.
I want the good ones.
Yeah, I do too. Do you think it's going to be good? Like, do you think the quality is going to be there?
I think it will look very good. I think it's going to look like a big budget movie. I think it's going to look like a Conjuring universe movie, for better or worse. You know, they've got some good imagery going for them, but I think sometimes that's a little shallow. And that's what I worry about, is that it's going to be monster heavy and not character heavy. You know,
I would have to agree with you on that. And on that very disturbing note, Jen, where can you be found online if you so wanted to be found?
Well, if you want to hear me talk about Stephen King for many, many, many more hours, you can check out the Losers Club podcast. I'm one of the co-hosts there. And we are just talking about all kinds of Stephen King. We have Hollywood King episodes where we do updates for the various rumblings that we're hearing. You can also find me at Jen Ferratu on various social media platforms. You can find me co-hosting also the Girls on the Boys podcast, which is about the boys, and writing for Dread Central. I have a column about killer women. And just follow me and I'll post it all.
You heard her. You have to do it. Okay, well, Jen, it was so cool and fun talking with you today. Don't go anywhere. I'm going to hit stop. Let's see what happens. Thank you so much for listening to Development Hell. If you enjoy this podcast, then please do us a major favor of leaving us 5 stars and writing a positive review. It really makes all the difference in the world. We'll see you next week with a brand new episode of Development Hell.
Thank you for listening to the Dread Podcast Network.